Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And my guest today, whom I will get to in a few moments, is one of the most thoughtful people I know in the field of psychology and psychotherapy. And I'm really looking forward to sharing thoughts with him. Before going to that, my usual practice has been to give a little tidbit of information or commentary. Well, today's commentary leaves me almost speechless, at least when I first realized what had happened. There's been a lot of talk about the DSM-5 and the various changes it has made. Well, one of the most drastic, far-reaching, and destructive changes, as far as I can tell, has not been discussed at all. And that is the transformation, the gutting, the destruction of the concept of neuroleptic-induced tardive dyskinesia. Neuroleptic meaning antipsychotic drug-induced tardive dyskinesia. If you look at the old DSM-4, the most recent edition of 2000, before this new DSM-5, you'll find that pages 803 through 805, three full pages, are devoted to tardive dyskinesia, and its relationship is discussed to the antipsychotic drugs by the very naming of it. And in it, the devastating figures, conservatively given but still devastating, are given for the abnormal movement disorder caused so frequently by drugs like Abilify, and by the old ones, Haldol, and the new ones, Seroquel, by all of the drugs that are given to psychiatric patients for supposedly bipolar disorder, psychosis, often given to children for behavioral control. Well, these drugs, according to the old DSM, produce tardive dyskinesia in 20 to 30% of the patients given the drugs longer term. That's a devastating figure. It's actually much worse than that. The incidence of individuals is 3 to 5% a year, cumulative, so that after 3 years, you're going to have 9 to 15% of people getting TD. In the elderly, they say the prevalence is 50%. And the incidence, an astonishing 25% to 30% a year, cumulative. We're talking about a disaster. And it goes on to describe in some detail various associated problems with tardive dyskinesia. Well, this is a very serious problem. Psychiatrists are often getting sued for this. I've been involved in dozens and dozens of suits. And one of the things that are used, that I use as an expert in these suits to show that doctors should know how bad this problem is that I cite the diagnostic manual as a source of information that every psychiatrist has at his fingertips or her fingertips. Well, they have pretty much just gutted this thing right out of the DSM-5. There's now a very abstract, short paragraph about it that doesn't even emphasize antipsychotic or neuroleptic drugs, doesn't give any figures, doesn't describe how the drugs suppress the very symptoms they're causing, and so on. So I think one of the real goals they set for themselves with the new DSM-5 is to take out this very vivid description of the iatrogenic or doctor-caused disorder, tardive dyskinesia. And you can hear me kind of stammering as I talk about it. I'm dismayed. I just came upon this yesterday, and it's one more indication of just how corrupt the profession is, how self-serving psychiatry is, how serving of the drug companies psychiatry is. I'll move on from that to a much more pleasant subject, my friend Dathan Paterno. Dathan is spelled with a D, Dathan Paterno. He's a PsyD. He has created the Park Ridge Psychological Services Clinic. Park Ridge, it's outside of Chicago, and it's a real clinic. He founded it and runs it. He's got a number of people working for him, working there for themselves. He has an excellent book, Desperately Seeking Parents, came out in 2010. My best tribute to him is that my daughter, Allie, who has given birth to two grandchildren, one 13 months and one 5 years, who's the best mom I know, my daughter, Allie, loves Dathan Paterno's work and communicates with him on Facebook and other modern ways that are beyond me, and thinks a great deal of him and his influence on her and on other people, other parents. I invited Allie to be on the show today, but lo and behold, she can't make it, and guess why? This is the hour that she's readying our 13-month-old grandchild, Ginger, and our 13-month-old grandchild, getting him ready for his afternoon nap. So she didn't think she'd be able to make the show. I'm going to have her on sometime, just me and her, talk about child rearing. So, hello, Dathan. You're there, I hope.
I am. Good to talk to you, Peter.
Good, good. tell me where you'd like to begin.
Well, first of all, I wanted to make a comment about your lamenting the change from DSM-4 to DSM-5. I agree with you 100%. I've been following over the last couple years some of the commentary through the work groups and others who were in previous manifestations of the DSM and their lamentations about the changes. And I couldn't agree more that this latest debacle is really devastating to psychiatric patients and to people who have not yet been thrown onto the psychiatric bus. I think that the one that you mentioned is particularly grievous, and I can't believe it. I'm shaking my head when you were saying that. I didn't realize that they had gutted that piece out. And it's no surprise, really, when you can use somebody's own material to hold psychiatry accountable, they're going to try to avoid that in the next document, and it looks like that's exactly what they've done. So I share your disappointment about that, but that just means that we have to fight harder to educate people, both the consumers and the main referral sources that get people into the merry-go-round of psychiatry.
One of the things I wanted to talk about in regard to you, which I didn't, and I want to pick up on, and it fits into this overall context, is the courageous statements that you make on your home page. I'm not going to read them all, but I want to read to folks what Dathan Paterno is saying about what he believes, because I wish every psychologist in America would have this understanding and this courage. Just to read to you briefly, the Facebook says, speaking of the homepage says, speaking of him, he, that is Dr. Paterno, adamantly denies the currently held myth that emotional disorders and problems are the result of genetically transmitted biochemical imbalances. And another statement, which I'd be interested in the kind of courage that you maybe had to muster to just come out and say it. Dr. Paterno denies that psychotropic medications are necessary, effective, or generally safe. Instead, he utilizes non-medical alternatives, which have been proven in an ever-expanding body of research and also in his professional experience, to be largely more effective, safe, and humane. Nathan, I was struck by your courage. I hadn't read that before. How long have you had that up? And do you think you're giving courage to other psychologists who seem so scared about taking a position?
I hope so. And it's been my experience in the last 5 years since our practice has started to take interns and practicum students. When they are looking for practicum sites and internship sites, they come across my website, and several of them have eagerly contacted me and said, I didn't know that somebody believed this way. You mean that we can actually help people without referring them for psychiatric drugs? And I said, yes, and if you want to be here, you don't have to agree exactly to the degree that I do, but I want to teach you that there are better, safer, and more permanent ways of helping people, more integrative, that can not only help people but not harm people and actually get at the underlying problem or problems. And people's face just light up. I think there's a new generation of clinicians coming out there who aren't hardened in the psychiatric community. I think some people who exist already who have been practicing for a number of years are jaded, and they don't, I guess their mindsets are more gelled, and they believe that you can't really exist as a psychotherapist without referring for psychiatric drugs. And, you know, I don't have it on my website, but one of the things that I brag about is that I almost never get referrals from psychiatrists, particularly biopsychiatrists. And that's a badge of honor for me, because I don't need them, because we know how to help people at their core, in their heart, in their soul, which is really what psychology is all about. Obviously, the word psyche means soul. And I believe very strongly that we are here to heal people's souls at the deepest level. And when we can touch them there and we can show them that whether it's depression or anxiety or mood swings or behavioral disorders are not biologically based, but they're spiritually based, they're relationship based, they're existentially based, people are really drawn to that. And so, yes, I started that website right when I started my practice about 6 years ago. And I figured, you know, if I'm going to start my own practice, I might as well go for broke. I'm just going to put it all out there. And it's really been joyfully successful. People have really taken to it.
Well, I just love what you're saying. I'm in 100% agreement about everything you're saying. And it's very practical and down to earth, too. I mean, in dealing with somebody who is being overwhelmed by what other people would call psychosis, by voices, by anxiety and fear, I'll talk with them about God and about their belief in God and about using help from God to give them help with the terrors they're struggling with. And it can be like a miracle. It can be just profound, and that's just a very practical application of it. But I think what you're saying in general about helping people understand that healing isn't about a drug patch, which is actually going to corrode your brain, this little patch, but it's about yourself, your whole self.
Sure. You know, the more I practice, the more I'm convinced that there are three types of people when it comes to those deepest levels of understanding or inquiring about life meaning and purpose, and some people call it existential questions and conflicts. There's the first type of person is the type who does not think at all about meaning of life things. They just don't have that on their radar screen. They're just out for pleasure, and they're happy-go-lucky generally, and they just don't consider those questions. And that's fine. Those type of people generally don't come in for psychotherapy, to be honest with you. The second type is the type who has considered some meaning of life or purpose or existential questions, but they table it, they suppress it, they repress it, they deny those things. And it sometimes pops up when troubles in life come up, when relationships break up, when they graduate from high school or college, and it's just kind of, it aggravates them sometimes, but they're able to suppress those questions at times. And then the third type is the man or woman who's every day they're bothered by or constantly thinking about meaning of life questions, and until they have it resolved, they just can't go on. And those two last types of people, I think, are the ones who are in therapy offices most often. And yet when they go to a psychiatrist, the psychiatrist generally does not ask them about meaning of life, about purpose, about those deepest levels that bring peace and great joy to a person. And so, you know, and certainly they don't get that kind of talk in school settings. And so most people just don't talk about it. It's not part of most people's vernacular. And so they're not used to addressing these things and addressing them head on and really critically examining meaning of life questions. And so it bothers them, but because they don't have it resolved, they have to go to another level of to try to feel happy, to try to feel some semblance of peace. And so they go to other things like pleasure, whether it's drugs or sex or massage or sports or music or any of the sensory things, which are good, but they don't bring deep, permanent joy or peace. And by the time they get to my office and I start to ask them questions, I dig up some of these meaning of life things, and more often than not, if they haven't resolved them, I tell them that, you know, we could probably help you learn how to deal with panic attacks, or we could probably help you with better sleep and exercise and diet, and you could probably feel a little bit better, or we could help you discipline your child better so that they behave a little bit better, and that will create a little less tension. But if you have meaning of life questions, if you're struggling with those things, they are going to bite you, and they are going to, you know, really gnaw at you until you address them head on and finally resolve them satisfactorily. And whatever conclusion you come to, whether it's religion or spirituality or something else, you have to do that. And people love to hear that because they get a sense that their struggles are meaningful. I'm depressed or anxious, and it's telling me something about me that's really important. And I think the psychotherapist's job is to point that out and validate those questions and concerns and conflicts and walk through that with somebody. And it's a real pleasure to do that, Peter. I know you've done that with people, and it really brings me a lot of joy and pleasure in my work. So it's that's what I really ultimately feel is the biggest value that I bring people in psychotherapy.
Well, I love what you're saying. Just some random elaborations. And I'm not the first at all to observe this, that the people who get labeled schizophrenic or have manic-like episodes, who feel like they are disintegrating, almost always are thinking about and struggling with what you're calling existential or spiritual issues.
Yes.
And that if you're not open to those, you're not going to be able to have a meaningful or a fully meaningful conversation with somebody who's struggling with their very existence.
Yes.
As happens with folks.
Sure. Sure. I mean, the two biggest questions I think that happen in a person's life that brings mental illness, that if it's not, and I know we could quibble about the term mental illness, but you know, psychiatric or psychological crisis, you know, psycho-spiritual crisis, you call it, I love that term, is am I safe and am I lovable, valuable, and worthwhile? And if you don't have those two questions resolved, you are going to be depressed or anxious, or in certain situations, so depressed and anxious that you're going to become psychotic, because then you have to flee from those questions that will torture you. And I know others have posited that, you know, schizophrenia is that. It's running away from the torture of not feeling safe and doing whatever it takes on the deepest level to preserve that safety.
It's like I'm hearing somebody in a different voice say that. Well, it is not like it is. Hearing someone from a different personality saying exactly the same things that I believe and feel. And quite often, one of the most basic things that I try to help someone with when they're really going through hell on earth is that they're safe, that at least in this office they're safe, and that if they ask God for help, they may feel safer when they leave the office. And it's the same for me. I have to remind myself many times that I'm safe. Safe in the deepest spiritual way. I'm not safe from attack because I have so many enemies, very large out there. But I'm safe in some more profound way of doing what I believe in, of trying to be as loving as I can. And starting with my relationship with Ginger and my relationship with God. Wow. So what are you thinking?
I'm thinking I wish more people would understand just how important their existential resolution is, whatever it is. You know, I'm a theist, I'm a Christian, and so specifically I have answers to those existential questions, but it's really rewarding for me when somebody comes in with a different faith or a different even set of possible answers to these existential questions, that I can have deep respect for their ability to answer those questions differently than I do, but they still understand that this is a safe environment. You know, I'm very big fan of Lord of the Rings, and there's a town in Lord of the Rings called it's the Elvish place, Rivendell, and it's a refuge for people. And so I try to make my office and my, you know, physically how I make it up and how I talk to people, I try to make it like a refuge so that people know that there is a place in the universe and there is a place in their universe where they can be safe, where they are no matter what, religion, gender, age, creed, sexuality, anything like that, they are valued and loved and worthwhile, and nobody's going to hurt them. And I know you know this, but when a person deeply believes that at least one place they can be like that, they start to wonder, I wonder if the rest of the world might be like this too, and this office isn't the only place that I can have a good relationship or a safe relationship where I can feel loved and worthwhile and valuable. And so then we start to experiment with going out into the world and finding more pockets of safety and value. And that's, I think, the ultimate gift of psychotherapy, is saying, okay, you don't need me all the time to be this, because I want you to go out into the quote-unquote real world and get what you have here elsewhere. And I find that psychotherapy, at least when we really follow our ethical guidelines, we're pushing people to be independent with that and not so dependent on us that they can't get what they need in the real world. In deep contrast to psychiatry, which fosters dependence on the drugs and on the psychiatrist, him or herself, which is why I think that it's just a superior system.
Yes, it's definitely a moral, spiritual counseling. It's not just what we call psychodynamics. It's about something so much more than that. You know, and it's so much about relationship, as you're saying. It is astonishing the extent to which relationship in itself, a loving relationship in itself, makes people or allows people to feel safe. Those two concepts you used, safe and loved. And that's where lifelong relationships become so important, where marriage or a lifelong love relationship becomes so important, because people find well-being and safety in a relationship with another human being, and they can feel very similar experiences in relationship to whatever they understand to be the higher power or the greater meaning in life.
Right. which is what it brings up the whole tragedy of psychiatric drugs, because ultimately what they do is the drugs really reduce that ability to be in touch with that part of yourself, the part that yearns for value and meaning and love and peace, and it gives a superficial numbing of that. And yet, what is the greatest miracle of all, I think, is that in spite of drugs suppressing that and reducing empathy and self-reflection, people still come out wanting to be loved and valued and safe. And psychiatry, even at its worst, can't quite destroy the soul, that people still ache and yearn for that at the deepest level. But sometimes they go through years and years of brain damage and being told that they just have a biochemical imbalance, that essentially they're just a brain that's broken, or a bunch of atoms that aren't functioning properly or in the right place, and they are devalued in that deepest place, yet that indomitable spirit eventually and inevitably, I think, cries out to be understood and loved and valued. And I think that we have to create a space for people to escape that.
Even people that I've seen who have been damaged by lobotomy still have a shining at times and at moments of their spirit through the tangled, broken wiring of the brain. And I've seen people, even after electroshock treatment, where they know they haven't fully recovered all of their cognitive abilities, go on to live better lives than before once they've gotten in touch with their spirituality and their desire to love and be loved, and putting that into the practice of their daily living. I don't usually mention my books on the show, but you brought up psychospirituality, and I do want to let people know, because they probably don't, that in my work, I deal with this the most explicitly and the most detailed in Toxic Psychiatry, a book which I think is more alive today than when it was first published. And that's where I talk about the overwhelm of emotions that really is at the root of the helplessness that people feel, and how psychospiritual growth is the answer. We'll be going to break in a minute. I want to remind people I'm talking with Dathan Paterno, and he's the founder and director of Park Ridge Psychological Services, just outside of Chicago, and it's a real clinic. It's not just himself. It's got a group of people around him. Would you like to say just a word or two about your clinic, and then the music will start and we'll go to break?
Sure. I started about 6 years ago, after I was part of a practice that was very eager to diagnose ADHD in children and adults, and I just needed to break free of that and start my own place. And so I wanted a place that's close to the city, but also close to home. So I started my own place. It was just me. And as I mentioned before, I took what I thought was pretty much a big risk in explaining myself exactly how I am, that I don't believe in drugs and I don't believe in psychiatry, and I even opened the doors to help people get off of their psychiatric drugs. And lo and behold, very quickly, I got busy. And, I added a partner. And then, like I said, when it was known that I was taking interns, I got a couple really good ones, and we were able to give some free services to people, particularly veterans who were coming home with PTSD. And so that's been a real joy and pleasure for me to offer that. And then we've expanded to, 8 or 9 people. So it's really grown, particularly in the last few years.
All of you psychologists and psychotherapists, and we could start the music with this, all of you psychologists and psychotherapists, be brave. Be like Dathan Paterno. Be brave. It's the only way to go, ultimately. to have a really fulfilling professional practice. Let's take our break, and we'll be back shortly. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, returning with my guest, Dathan Paterno. Dathan, it's just wonderful to hear you talk about these issues. I'd love to hear you talk some about children and meaning, if you like, or anything you want to talk about. The mic is yours again.
Well, yeah, my expertise is children, but inevitably I wind up working with a lot of adults and adolescents, and particularly because of the point of view that I espouse and advertise. But I think that that children need to hear the language of meaning. They not only need to be loved, but they need to understand that they have innate value. And obviously, as parents, we want to instill in them that they're loved deeply and that they have a permanent place in our world and that their relationship with their parents is permanent, but that they also have permanent value that will transfer to when they go out into the world with other relationships, and whether it's marriage or single life, and whatever they do, that they have value, and that we can use the language of meaning and purpose and existential value. And I think children need to see that their parents have that on their radar screen, that they themselves have resolved to the ability that they can those existential issues. So I try both personally with my three children. I have two girls and a boy, one 13, one 10, and then my youngest is 8. We talk about these issues. We talk about what it means to be loved and to know your value and to know how worthwhile you are. And we question them on where does your value come from? Does it come from the fact that you're cute, or the fact that you are in shape, or the fact that you get good grades, or the fact that you can sing, or you're good at gymnastics, or whatever? If our children buy into that system, then life becomes a treadmill where they have to earn their value, because at some point they're going to fail. And they're going to be frustrated, they're going to be disappointed, and that's fine, and I think life is full of disappointments, and that's not a problem. But if their value is wrapped up in success or some kind of thing that they're good at, then I think they're going to run into trouble. And so it's really crucial for parents to instill in their children that no matter how they perform or how attractive they are, or what kind of success they have, that they have innate value, that they are so worthwhile just because they exist and because they're yours. And I think when kids really understand that, then it helps put things into perspective, and they put their eggs in the right basket, so to speak. And I think children can understand that from a very early age. Once children are verbal and they understand reasoning and they understand logic and they understand those words like value and meaning and purpose, they can learn that. And that's one of the reasons why I ran for local school board. I'm not very much a political person when it comes to being active in politics. I have my own political views, but I wanted to get the psychiatric community away from children as early as possible. So, because I knew that a lot of school districts have universal mental health screening, which is one of the ways that psychiatry gets their hands on children, and children get onto the psychiatric merry-go-round. So I ran for school board in the spring, in April, and happened to win. I think partly because of my background with child psychology and understanding child development. And so very quickly, I requested from the board president, who's a very gracious man, for me to be on the policy committee. And he accepted that. And so I was put on the policy committee. And lo and behold, one of the first policies we looked at when we were reviewing them is that the district supported universal mental health screening. And I think you probably have written about this, but the whole history of universal mental health screening is not that old. I think it was born out of the Columbine situation and a lot of fears that we could and should attempt to try to find the Eric Harris's and Dylan Klebold's through mental health screening in the schools. And yet psychology is not very good at finding those children. And mental health screening, as you know, has a terrible rate of success, far too many false positives and far too many false negatives. And so I looked through that and I made a big fuss about it, went to a bunch of parents in the neighborhood, got their backing to get rid of that universal mental health screening, and through some interesting negotiations, we were able to get it off the policy for the next 3 years. And so I feel really good about that. That was a really good success. But
let me applaud. I've not applauded before my radio show. It's a new addition. I'm applauding that. Good work. Good work.
Thank
I think
you.
It takes a certain patience and centeredness to go into a situation like that. I might not have that patience and centeredness to be in that setting and work the way you did. Good work.
Thank you. Well, I think when I put it in terms that they understood that, you know, it's just not going to work. Not only is it not the job of the school district, particularly a public school district, to be diagnosing very complex disorders. I didn't use that argument, but I said that they're just not successful. Now, that might mean in a few years somebody's going to come and say, well, these mental health screenings will be successful, and so we're going to have to fight that again at some point. But we're at least staving them off for a few years, which I think is good, and I think we're going to hopefully rescue a lot of children from being misdiagnosed and mislabeled and mistreated.
Now, one of the big centers of this was from Lori Flynn, a former head of NAMI, an organization funded by the drug companies, who then went to Columbia University, I believe, and was a major figure in pushing for this, just as she was pushing for drugs, shock treatment and lobotomy, and involuntary treatment at NAMI, at the behest of the drug companies. And that has folded. Have you followed that?
No, I didn't know that, but that's great news.
Oh, you didn't know? Yes.
No.
It's folded up. It's within the last few months. People have wondered why. Of course, it's been subject to criticism, I think, congressional investigation. But it has folded from one of its root sources. So, gosh, sometimes a little headway is made.
Right. And all politics is local, they say. And, you know, if I set my sights on joining the Senate or something like that, I probably wouldn't succeed. But there are places where the mental health industry is trying to get in, and that's at the local level. And I think that a lot more people should be involved, and there's a little bit more leeway and a little bit more control that we can have, benevolent control, to protect our children from these things. And kids are just so sensitive at these early ages. You know, we have a lot more work to do. I want to make sure that we can help kids get away from no tolerance policies and things like that. That's the next one on my hit list. I'm tired of children getting in trouble for normal childhood behaviors like making guns out of Legos. You know, a six-year-old shouldn't be suspended from school because he is a normal kid and likes to go bang bang with his finger. That's a normal child development, and when we shame those kind of behaviors, I think we create far more problems than are necessary, and so that will be next on my radar screen.
One of the things I wish, and I'm sure you do too, is that that energy of policing children could go into a no-bullying tolerance.
Yeah.
That would be so much more healthful to really, really work on imposing a moral authority within the schools for principals and assistant principals and guidance counselors and teachers to get together and to tell the students and tell the parents that there is no bullying allowed.
Mm-hmm.
That bullying will be dealt with directly. It doesn't mean that with punishment necessarily. You set your policy on very little tolerance or no tolerance for bullying. You can be intervening at a much earlier level than one kid beating up another kid or somebody being horribly ridiculed. You can begin to intervene earlier and teach respect.
No, I agree with that. That is one of the policies that we're going to be looking at on the local school board. And it's a challenging one because on the one hand, we want teachers and principals and other administrators to have some flexibility and to use their best judgment to deal with children, individual children, because they're all unique. And each bullying episode is also unique. There's a broad range of what people call bullying, and that's one of the things that we're really struggling with, is if one child calls another child a name, is that necessarily bullying versus some things that are clearly bullying, like assaults? And obviously we need to have no tolerance for that, and there needs to be, you know, significant consequences for that. But what is the threshold for just a simple, understandable conflict that's not handled well versus a systematic way of devaluing another human being? And that, I think, is the level or the line that we're looking at is a chronic, a pattern of devaluing another human being via words, via physicality, via shutting somebody out, either, you know, in person or on social media. I think that's what we're calling bullying, and we're definitely trying to figure out how to intervene earlier and making sure that we have the broadest range of adults involved, teachers, administrators, parents, police if necessary, and then trying to take care of things in-house as much as we can, but recognizing that children need to be protected from these things.
Yeah, and I think sensitive early interventions where a teacher notices any kind of abuse and addresses it with the child,
mm-hmm.
who's the perpetrator, or the child's family, maybe on some occasions with some of the other children involved. But I think it's a sensitive alertness and a being empowered to believe that one of your purposes as a teacher and a principal is to teach respectful conduct.
Right.
And even caring conduct.
Right, right. And that,
does that make
I absolutely
sense?
Agree with you. And our district has that as part of our policy, you know, that we teach respect and civil behavior, and a lot of districts are using those buzzwords and putting some policies into place for that. Where it becomes really a challenge is when a school wants to intervene. And particularly if they want to hold the child accountable for something, they have to get some buy-in from the parents. And that seems to be the most difficult. So if two children get into an argument and there's some name-calling or some shoving, and in the teacher's judgment, child A was responsible for it, child A's parents, generally, there's a struggle to get those parents to support the school and their interventions. And then the teachers or the school district are really hamstrung, and they can't do, I mean, there's a crisis there. So the child then has two authority figures kind of at odds with each other. You know, it's almost like when mom and dad don't back each other up with discipline. If the parents and the school aren't united, then you have a big problem. And the child will either invalidate the parents or the school, or just decide nobody knows what they're talking about, and then you have an even bigger problem.
Do you feel that from the school board level, you're going to be able to influence the environment, increase the safety, that all-important word, the safety of the school environment?
Yes. One of the principles that I'm trying to use is trying to get that unanimity between the district and the parents, that before we start talking to the children about what the rules and the expectations and possible consequences are, let's get the parents involved and get their buy-in. And then we can say, guess what? All the adults in your life agree that this is unacceptable and this is acceptable, and here's what the consequences are, and here's what we're going to be doing. I think if we get that kind of unanimity up front, just like I teach parents to do when we talk about raising children and discipline and all of that, you have so much more flexibility, and your authority is much more solid, and then you can do a lot more with it. I think the children respond much better when you have mom and dad and the teachers and principals all on the same page. That's absolutely critical. So that's what I'm trying to get that, some kind of training between the teachers and the parents and the administrators so that everybody can be on board with that.
That sounds like something worth doing and studying. Are you going to try to put in anything in the way of studying what's happening?
No,
maybe measuring effects?
Yeah, that's one of the things we want to do, is to have some of the schools do it one way, where we just do like a pilot program where we have the teachers, administrators, and the parents involved. Let's do that with 2 out of the 5 schools, and let's see what happens in terms of frequency and intensity of discipline events. And this is all very similar to one of the themes I think that I have in my work with children is that if you don't have the rules and the expectations set ahead of time, the children are going to be confused. And when children are confused, they're left to their own devices. They don't make very good decisions. And I think they're scared and they feel less safe. And that's what our children need primarily in order to learn, both whether it's academic or social-emotional things.
The children do need to feel loved and safe, not only in our therapy offices, but in their schools and, of course, everywhere we can.
Yes.
It's not realistic to think we can take the fear out of growing up or being a person and the threat and the danger, but the human goal is for people to feel safer and to feel loved. And sometimes that involves struggle. Sometimes that involves fighting, and because it isn't necessarily a safe world.
Sure. Let me say one other thing about what we're trying to do, and it's difficult in a public school setting, but I strongly believe that one of the cultural realities that we have now is that parents are farming out their children for more and more slices or spheres of their life. So we send them to public school to learn their ABCs. We send them to church or synagogue to learn their stuff about God. We send them to the therapist to learn how to control their anger. And parents are in some ways absolved of being front and center and the primary agents of change in the child's life. And I think that's terrible. We need to reverse course, and I'm all for children going to church and synagogue and going to public school and going to a therapist, but the parents need to be involved with all of that, and all of those outside sources need to, I think, use or emphasize that the parents are the ones who are the primary agents of change. And I'm sure you've experienced, Peter, when a parent wants to bring their child in for psychotherapy and you get the sense that they kind of just want to drop off the kid and you do the work on the child and then return the child in a better state, right? But that's not how psychotherapy works for children, okay? Maybe sometimes the child needs to work on just a few things But if there's major change, we know that we only have the child for 45 minutes to an hour and a half a week, but then they go back to the old system with parents who are either unaware of how to parent them properly, or they're undoing what we're teaching them. And so we absolutely have to get the parents involved, and we have to support them and let them know that they are the primary agents of change. They're the ones who are going to make Junior behave better, or help Junior feel better, or understand things and feel safer and more loved. And I think when parents hear that they have that kind of power, that we can really build them up and equip them to do what ultimately is their job, I think parents love that. And I wish, and that's what I'm trying to do on the school board, is get more parental involvement with these things, but also in the therapy offices, get more parental involvement so that they're the ones who helped Junior, not me. I don't want the credit. I'm just the one who has an interesting system that I think works. All I do is teach the parents, and they do the work. And so that when they're done with me, if anything else happens, they can fix it.
Yeah, absolutely. I spend very little time alone with children. I think preteens, I may spend 5 or 10 minutes alone with them if I feel like it.
Mm-hmm.
With teens, depending on their wishes, I might see one for individual therapy. But I tend to do it through the family. I tend to do family therapy. I thought of a new phrase. I don't know if it's been used before, but we're outsourcing parenthood. Outsourcing
right.
parenthood.
Right.
It's a disaster.
It is, absolutely.
I wonder if you and I sat together for hours, if we would find areas of strong disagreement. I'm not going to seek them on the air. But it's amazing whenever I talk with you, which is not nearly often enough, I always find this very, very close correspondence in how we think about stuff.
Yeah, it's really, I love hearing that. And, you know, part of the reason why you're experiencing that is because I've learned quite a bit from you and your work, and it emboldened me to look at things in a different way. And look, I think that's a great legacy of yours, is that you've given some clinicians, you know, from another generation, the ability to not only understand things from a different perspective, but have seen your work over the years and how amazing it's been for people, and the you know, how effective it's been. And so I feel emboldened because of your success, and hopefully the next generation will get the same from me and there on down the line.
Thank you. Comments in our last few minutes about what it's like to be Dathan Paterno and how much better it is being that way than going with the establishment. Give some hope and faith.
Sure. Well, I used to be part of the establishment. In my early career was in a psychiatric hospital in Grand Rapids, Michigan, working with children and adolescents. And I remember viewing the psychiatrist very much as a godlike figure. And whenever I could get the psychiatrist to talk to me or approve of something that I had done, I just felt enormous value, and it was great. It rubbed my ego. And I remember I was one of the people to participate in convincing hesitant children and adolescents to take their medication orally so that they didn't have to get a shot. And I was good at cajoling and convincing people to do that, and I felt really good about that. But over the years of my being in that hospital, I saw very little improvement. I saw the revolving door. So-and-so would get out after a couple weeks, and then they would come back in, and the same problems would come back, and nothing was ever getting better. And eventually I saw that children were getting worse because of the psychiatric drugs. I finally saw it. But, of course, it wasn't until I read Toxic Psychiatry that I understood why that was happening. And then the light bulb went off. And then I could see things from a completely different perspective. And that's when I went to graduate school. And so I was able to go through graduate school already having made somewhat of a shift, not quite sure that I could develop enough skill, ability, and knowledge to effectively do things differently than what I had seen in the past. But lo and behold, practice and practice and practice, lots of failures, some successes, and then I started to do things more my way, and learning from other people, which I think is so critical, particularly after graduate school. And I keep telling my graduate students, you know, you're going to do most of your learning after you're done with your degree, which is very exciting. But I've always relished the underdog role. I've always relished kind of going against the mainstream. That's kind of my personality. So it's I relish the opportunity to show people that we can do it differently. And lo and behold, it's worked, and it's worked very well. And it really encourages me to continue to learn how to do it better so I can help more people and get more people away from psychiatry and more toward a more integrative, you know, I'm trying to not to use the word holistic because it has so many, unfortunate meanings to it,
yeah.
But different ways of doing things that really work and are safer and are more humane and humanistic.
Have you been threatened in any way by making such direct statements? Like, again, on your homepage, Dr. Paterno denies that psychotropic medications are necessary, effective, or generally safe. Instead, he utilizes, in effect, you say, better approaches. Any price for that?
Sure. There have been people who have contacted me and asked what I would do with a particular problem, and I tell them in general what I would not do. I wouldn't use meds. I wouldn't refer for, you know, a med eval, and I would try to get at the underlying problem or such and such. And I've gotten scathing emails and phone calls and responses, people walking out of my office in a huff, not having known what my viewpoint was.
Right.
And that's fine. And I'm going to lose some people because it's just not a match with their preconception. And that's okay. I'm totally okay with that. But no, I've never been threatened. I've just been,
Great.
I've had the snide remark.
Well, I just hope that this hour will be listened to by therapists around the world. I want to thank Dathan Paterno, Park Ridge Psychological Services, just outside of Chicago. Pleasure and honor and joy to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's been an honor, and I appreciate it. Thank you.